Hello, Insiders. Thanks for tuning back in. You're listening to Therapy Insiders Podcast. Continuing with the recent theme of exercise and looking at different avenues to progress physical therapy, we have on this episode Johnny Owens. And we've had Johnny on before last year. And Johnny is leading the way with blood flow restriction training. Last time when Johnny was on, we got into some of the science stuff and some details. Since then, it's really, really grown, especially in mass media, because Johnny was recently on ESPN and he's been working with a lot of professional teams. And there's been a lot of conversations on social media, and I've been getting a ton of questions about blood flow restriction training. So, what's a guy to do? Get the best in the field to answer some questions, right? That's exactly what we did. I reached out to Facebook groups, DPT student group, social media such as Twitter, and said, hey, what questions do you have for Johnny? And that's what this episode turned out to be. We took your questions, we asked them right to Johnny, and every question that we got, he answered. I hope you enjoy them. I think they were great, great questions, especially from the students. And we learned a lot in the process. So let's get right into it. Johnny Owens. All right, Insiders. Therapy Insiders is sponsored by WebPT, the end-to-end business solution for private practice rehab therapists, providing everything from documentation and scheduling to RCM services, billing software, and outcomes tracking. WebPT's mission is to help rehab therapists, such as yourselves, achieve greatness in practice. And that starts with education. That's why WebPT hosts a free webinar every month. And they're pretty good. Join Dr. Heidi Janenga and Charlotte Bonet on May 19th as they unveil 5 top secret ways insurance companies beat you on reimbursements and explain to you how you can turn the tables in your favor. To learn more and register, visit webpt.com/PT billing. You don't want to miss that one. Therapy Insiders is also sponsored by Intake Q. That's the letter Q. Do you want to improve your patient experience before your patient even walks into the clinic? Of course you do. Then you definitely want to check out Intake Q, digitizing the patient intake experience. Check out Intake Q, that's what the letter Q, .com/UpDocMedia to get a 2-week free trial and 50% off the first month of service. You definitely can't beat that. Check it out. And now, on to Therapy Insiders with our guest, Kelly Starrett. Strap in. Welcome back to Therapy Insiders. Dr. Gene Shirakarad here with Dr. Erson Religioso. Probably a little sleep deprived in baby mode as I am. Erson, what's up, man?
Well, you know, I'm lucky. My wife is actually letting me sleep most nights, and she only gets me if it's an emergency. But our poor little one has a cold, and he's probably been waking up maybe every 1 hour or every 2 hours. 2 hours is good. So my wife is, you know, she's letting me sleep so we're not both zombies. So I can help out during the day and drop the kids off at school or pack their lunches and basically do a lot of the stuff.
Mr. Mom.
Yeah. It's tough. But none of our kids have ever slept well. I mean, Gene basically told me today that the second feeding's at 6 a.m. and I wanted to shoot myself in the head.
All right, it's not 6 a.m., it's like 4:30, and she doesn't want to go back to sleep after that. She was getting 6 hours of sleep. Now that I said that, now that you called me out, she's probably just going to be completely like monster baby in the middle of the night.
No how, but I started smoking again, as in the Weber smoking.
You got to classify that statement.
Don't take that out of context, people. Don't quote me in this podcast about that. No, I started using my Weber Smoky Mountain again. It's just easier when my wife's not cooking all kinds of fancy vegan recipes for me to actually smoke something that will last us like, you know, half a week. So,
well, I think aside from other things, our guest today should be able to give us advice, if nothing else, on beef brisket. Urs, why don't you go ahead and introduce him, and let's hear about some beef brisket recipes.
Yeah, well, we are very fortunate to have back on Therapy Insiders podcast, Johnny Owens from Owens Recovery Science. Actually, I think last time we had you on, Johnny, did you even have Owens Recovery Science as a brand or website yet?
Probably not. I don't really remember how long ago or when that was, but it seems like probably not.
Yeah. And since then, you may have noticed Johnny's been on ESPN. He's been featured in Forbes.
Just a big time now.
Sports Illustrated.
Yeah, you may have heard of some of these outlets.
You were in the swimsuit edition, right?
I was. They painted me to cover up all the hair.
Oh man! So how do you make a good beef brisket, Johnny?
Low and slow, man. You gotta get a lot of coffee or beverage of choice and put it on a very low, slow heat and let it go for a long time and don't rush it. And that's pretty much it. So, yeah. I said, I hope you're not wasting smoking with like vegetables or something like that.
No, I only do that at the end when I still have like so many coals left. But I do have one question for you before we get started. Would you do Green Egg or Weber Smoky Mountain? What's your preference?
I'm more of a just the old, you know, the old pit where they use a big old oil barrel.
Okay. Nothing fancy.
Yeah, that fancy stuff, man. That's, you know, that your neighbors will laugh at you if you're using that type of stuff. You know, what I use nowadays, I use my brother-in-law because he'll do it and he does pretty decent. He uses too much smoke, but I basically talk his stuff up so he'll cook it and I don't have to do it anymore. And I just go over and eat.
That's fun, though. I mean, you know, it's fun. The long, slow roast. It's quite a... I just like having beer, checking on it every once in a while.
I hear you, man. It
sounds delicious.
I hear you. Well, when you guys,
I also just rent myself out for parties. When I'm not eating meat, I just do parties, and everyone else can enjoy it. So
that's a glutton for punishment, man. Why would you do that to yourself?
I'll do it for the garage series too. People want me to smoke something out there at the garage. I'll do it. I'll watch everyone else eat, and I'll eat like some. Veggies or something.
Nice. Shameless plug. Urson's coming to the Garage Series as Eclectic Approach class. That's in August 2016. You could sign up on updocmedia.com. Johnny, we got to get you out here for the Garage Series. Get it rolled up.
I know, man. Let's do it. Yeah, I need to get more Northeast action going. Although I just got back from a little whirlwind tour up there. But yeah, I definitely need to get up there some more.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed you in Buffalo.
I know, man. I had... Seriously, I had no idea. I was there for 3 days, so we should have linked up.
Yeah.
Should have, could have.
Yeah, it's a great place. I had no idea there was so much wine there.
Hey, we have nothing else to do.
I thought you meant like they were just whining because Buffalo Bills suck. No, that's not what you meant.
Right. Well, like I always say, luckily I'm not a fan.
That's not what you meant. Yeah. All right. My interpretation. My bad. All right. Johnny, we got so much to cover for BFR, and I wish it was us asking questions, but I posted that you're going to be on the podcast again on various physical therapy Facebook pages and the DPT student page, which they've asked incredible questions that are really astute. I love talking with the DPT students on that forum because they really are excited about stuff like this. So we're going to ask a bunch of questions and we'll kind of try to get a little context behind the questions, but this episode just might turn into an entire Q&A from social media.
I'm ready for it, man.
All right, let's start out with Brian Jones. He asked, have there been any studies on the longer-term effects of BFR on the pituitary, i.e., does the release of HGH at lower loads with BFR affect future release of HGH positively or negatively during non-BFR training? How about during future BFR training? You got all that?
That's a good question.
So, yeah, it is. So the short answer is no. There hasn't been any long-term studies on it. There's a lot of questions with GH that we really don't understand. And then when we're really looking at you know, the easiest thing to study is exogenous, because you can control how much you're injecting into an individual and kind of measure that. When we're talking about endogenous release, you're kind of at the mercy of the pituitary. You're at the mercy of whatever training load you put on, be it high load or low load with BFR or whatever. So it's very hard to control. There hasn't been anything done. We do know that there's a pretty large spike of endogenous growth hormone after BFR training, but there's also a large spike after heavy load training. So, you know, if we can look at heavy load training and see that the effects on the pituitary aren't negative, we might, you know, just jump and say there's probably the similar type results with BFR, but we're not sure. It is interesting, and, you know, this is a segue, that we are able to manipulate GH endogenous output through something like BFR, especially if we're thinking about GH's role in the rehab type setting for potentials for collagen synthesis and maybe healing of structures. We don't know, again, for sure, because we don't know exactly what endogenous growth hormone really does, but we do know exogenous injections do help things like fractures heal faster and tendons heal faster and things like that.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool stuff. Is there something that is a study on this type of stuff? Is that important for the progression of BFR, or like what are the current studies focusing on to help kind of spread BFR or integrate it into more clinical applications or training applications?
So what BFR clinical studies are ongoing?
What is the emphasis now in terms of studies?
Yeah, well, it's exploded. You know, we've had such good clinical success, both in the military, in the civilian, and the professional ranks that I've been working with, that we've been able to take a lot of that data and really roll it into some pretty good trials. And so probably, you know, one of the most powerful things with BFR is the ability to turn on protein synthesis with it. And so if you look at what's called anabolic resistance, and that's essentially, you know, the protein synthesis guys have led us down this road to where we understand it better. And NASA was kind of the first group that really started looking at it, is when you take a limb, a lower extremity, and you immobilize it or non-weight bear it for a couple of weeks, you see protein synthetic rate drops in that limb. So not in the rest of the body, that doesn't change at all, but in that limb, which mimics a you know, an injury type pattern, after 2 weeks, you got about a 30% drop in protein synthesis, which equals, you know, almost a 10% loss of mass, especially in the thigh. Which if you look deeper into what that is, that's almost 350 grams, at least according to a couple of papers, of muscle tissue. And so if you don't really understand, well, what does that really look like? Well, the adult human heart is about 300 grams in size. So after a couple of weeks in a healthy individual, this anabolic resistance effect will diminish, you know, almost more than the size of your heart potentially in one of your patient's limbs. So what we're really interested in with BFR is, okay, well, now as rehab professionals, we need to understand how to turn protein synthesis on to get these folks out of anabolic resistance. I mean, anabolic resistance almost could, you know, we're looking at, it might be a gateway to sarcopenia, whereas folks get older, they're unable to really get into an increased protein synthetic rate. So with BFR, we know from some pretty good studies that if you do that with low loads, that we can increase what's called the mTOR-C1 pathway, which is the protein synthesis pathway. Even 24 hours later, it's significantly elevated, higher than that 30% loss. So then you have a tool for a clinician to start using something, you know, to get deep down on a cellular level to increase the protein synthetic rate and stop what is one of the biggest problems that we have in rehab. And that's, you know, this atrophy that we see after surgery, after injury, and even what some studies are showing us now with this anabolic resistance, even during a period of disuse or decreased ambulatory time, it starts to kick in as well. So from that and from our results and presenting some of this stuff, there's a ton of studies just looking at that side of it. So I think we're up to 5 ACL studies going on right now. We have one in the military, Memorial Hermann Healthcare System. Walt Lowe's the PI on that. Has a humongous study that just kicked off. Michigan's kicking a study off. Methodist in Houston's kicking a study off. Missouri, in Detroit, Beaumont, Detroit Lions guys have one as well. We have a total knee arthroplasty study going. We have a meniscus repair study going.
All right. So speaking of ACL stuff, we have Brandon Paulus ask, any talk with physicians to use these on post ACL repairs who have quad inhibition to improve early stage quad activation?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, obviously all those studies are at large centers, and physicians are some of the driving groups with it. So the orthopedic community has really jumped on and embraced this. Actually last week, my colleague presented at ANA, which is kind of the elite arthroscopy society. All the top dogs in orthopedics were there, to a standing room audience, presenting, you know, what we're seeing with this. So yeah, there's a lot of interest in seeing this with ACL, and it does look like from the studies that we see, BFR can increase muscle activity or IMG activity. So this can be a way that we can truly turn on the quad and not some of these kind of tricky hacky things that people try and do to get the muscle to turn on. You want to turn on the muscle, get down into the deep motor fibers and really get the large recruitment.
Nice. We definitely want to get those muscles recruited and firing. What kind of stuff are you doing? Is it just unloaded stuff with BFR, mm-hmm. or have you progressed any weight bearing, any squats, or is it just too much for the muscle to handle?
No. Not at all. So, I mean, we're all the way up with multiple teams from the college and professional ranks, so at, you know, higher performance type things, you know, incorporating this with higher loads as a way to potentially augment that heavy load training and maybe as a protective effect where you're not having as much muscle damage. This is real anecdotal and maybe from a from an animal study. We're still early on in that, but plenty of loading studies are going on. I mean, we have an Achilles tendinopathy study going, which, you know, is following kind of what we know about tendon pathology, and applying BFR to help augment that. We have a femur fracture study, which is, you know, early weight bearing and using BFR to potentially assist with bone healing and maintaining the muscle strength and size. So the loading stuff is definitely there.
The tendinopathy study, did you pilot that, or do you have any information in general about that? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, we did clinical pilot stuff, so not a published pilot. And then Shane Copenhaver, one of my colleagues, is in the military, submitted and got funded based on that with a what's called an AMTI grant, a new military medical technology grant. And so this study is running through Fort Bragg and through Fort Sam Houston. So we saw positive results. What we don't know is, you know, the functional changes seem to be there. The self-reported seem to be there. The strength changes seem to be there. We would like to understand it on a little bit deeper level. So we're going to use, it's called shear wave elastography to kind of look at the tensile changes in the tendon and, some of the deeper kind of structures that we can look at in there.
Are you doing with eccentric loading or both concentric and eccentric loading?
Well, I've never been a fan of just eccentric. The Alfredson protocol just seems to always fail miserably for me. It's very hard to get compliance for that one. It's a ton of, you know, a ton you're asking the patient. And then, you know, when you really look at the literature, there just doesn't seem to be anything compelling to show that eccentrics is better than concentrics, eccentrics. You know, there. I think there's one paper that showed eccentrics is better than concentrics only, and that wasn't really one of the best papers in the world. So, you know, tendons need load. They like progressive load. They don't like a sharp increase in load. And so we can use this as a way to start with a lower load and slowly increase loads, especially if we're looking at the calf. What we've seen anecdotally in the clinic and as well as, you know, like a paper from Stephen Patterson over in London on BFR, a higher load in the lower leg, you know, up to 50% 1RM with BFR seems to do better than the 20% load. So we will load it progressively as much as we can to get that the effects that we would like to see on the tendon itself, maybe resetting those tenocytes and starting to work on the healthy collagen that's there, as well as increasing the strength and hypertrophy of the surrounding musculature.
Yeah, I think an eccentric loading protocol is pretty tough because it pretty much hurts like hell, and you have to tell the patient that to some degree.
Yeah,
it,
right.
it's okay, yeah. But it would you are you basically finding that, you know, like anything else with BFR, they get the same amount of load with a lot less effort or resistance? Is that why you think you're having success?
Yeah, you know, it's a couple things. So for one, you know, I think, and you look at some of the people who really look deep into this tendon stuff, that there always is a muscle, you know, weakness, usually directly with the muscle involved with the tendon. So if you're talking patellar tendinopathy, the quad, or Achilles tendinopathy, the gastroxoleus group. So it's good to be able to do something where we know we're having an effect on those muscles. Secondly, this is a way that you can just kind of nicely, slowly increase load over time, but start at a little bit lower level. And what we've really seen too is when people have pain and you do BFR, the BFR is just, it's really, you know, it's kind of very distracting. You start to build up all those metabolites within the muscle, and all you really start to pay attention to usually is the muscle. And it almost distracts the patients away from what they might be feeling at the tendon. And so usually they do it, they feel better after they're done. I mean, most tendinopathies, if you do it right, you know, they should feel the tendon feel a bit better. But this seems to be a way they get done, they feel a little bit better, they get a little bit better buy-in, and they keep going. We transition them off of BFR fairly rapidly once that tendon gets in a fairly, you know, good state, that it can just start handling regular higher load training. And then we start doing higher load training and then progress to the SSCs. So get that plyo cycle in there. We go from horizontal to more vertical training, especially with a lot of the pro athletes I'm working with. That's kind of one of the missing steps that I think they're not hitting.
That's a great distinction, I think, to make. BFR is a technique that you use. It's not the entire treatment, right? The goal is to still progress them and load them gradually and then return them to whatever is functional for their needs.
Yeah, 100%. You know, it's a great, great resource early on in rehab when you can't load, when maybe you were doing what we call the cell swelling hypothesis, where we're trying to increase myocyte swelling to kick on protein synthesis, you know, where someone's just out of surgery or just out of injury, and then progressively load it. But as soon as we're able to get, you know, to fight off that anabolic resistance, get close to the strength that we would like to see to progress, then we get off of it and start going into heavier load and then more into our sports specific or work specific or whatever it is.
Nice.
That's it. I mean, people think, well, you know, you guys just do BFR for everything. Well, no way. If you can load heavy, I always say this, load heavy, but there's times you can after injury, there's times you can't, maybe you're elderly and that's just not great for you. Or there's times you can't, you know, with our pro guys where our college guys, they're in season. And maybe doing heavy load where you're getting muscle damage and breakdown isn't the best thing for you when you're trying to maintain, you know, your strength and size throughout a competitive, very grueling season. And so that's what a lot of the pro guys are doing too, using this as a way in season. You know, they periodize this to maintain the size, that ESPN piece. That's kind of, you know, we redid everything with Dwight Howard, the way that, you know, he traditionally trained to now, and he didn't have any issues with his knees. And then after that, if they can get back to traditional training, go for it.
Gotcha. Very cool. So if they're training, this is a kind of rolls into the question that Amy DePalto asked. What, Johnny?
I'm just throwing shout outs. I know who these people are, but I'm throwing shout outs just to make it cool.
Shouting out in the middle of my questions, man. Killing me. You're killing me. Killing my flow. All right. She was curious. Can BFR cause DOMS, DOMS, delayed onset muscle soreness?
If you look at the literature, yes, it can. If you look at what we typically see clinically, it's not very typical. You know, when I do these courses or work with teams, you know, well, in the morning we're doing the lab and going over it all. And by the afternoon, you know, I always ask, how's everyone feel? And almost never does anyone have any DOMS at that point, or, you know, when we kind of follow up the next day. And that's pretty much true of what we've seen in the clinic. But it has been reported when you look at indirect measures of muscle damage, which DOMS is an indirect measure, that there is some mild DOMS, there can be the next day and the day after. You typically, you know, if you look at mechanistically, does that make sense? It doesn't make 100% sense because there isn't really, it's such low load, there isn't, you know, much muscle damage that's involved or things that would potentially cause DOMS. And when you do direct measures of looking at things like CK, measuring, you know, muscle breakdown, those aren't real elevated from what we've seen in the literature. So But you definitely can. And we always warn the patients. We have a little patient handout that we give them and say, you know, there could be a little bit of soreness the next day or two. What confuses people is when you do BFR, you do have a large accumulation of lactate and metabolites within the muscle. And that acidity and that burning, most people, you know, they always feel like that is the same thing as when they're causing muscle damage. Because usually when you have a large byproduct from exercising heavy, you're breaking down muscle tissue, getting into heavier loads, you're building up that lactate. Lactate is just a byproduct of the anaerobic metabolism. It's not a sign of DOMS. And so we also try and educate our patients and athletes that, you know, this is just, you know, a substance in your muscle. This doesn't mean just because you're feeling like, oh my God, I'm going to be sore for the next 2 or 3 days. You probably won't.
Interesting. All right. Speaking of weightlifters, Dan Johnson, from the DPT student Facebook group, said, Johnny, how do you feel about using things like Ersin's Edge Mobility Bands or another brand to occlude blood flow? I know weightlifters do it, but I wouldn't feel comfortable doing it on a patient. And I think you answered this last time, but I was wondering if you had any changes in your opinion since last time we asked this, after I basically said, hey, I'm going to go try this.
I'm going to go wrap it around my neck band and see what happens.
Yeah.
And that's what I've always said on this too. You know, if you're going and weightlifting in the gym or you're doing something outside the clinic, you can wrap a tourniquet around your neck and I don't really care. That's completely fine because you're making that decision and you can do it to yourself. Now, as soon as you step into the clinical environment, things change. And, you know, for one, you know, there's different things you got to look at. If you're going to have a patient come in and you're going to bill them for a treatment, we're hoping that we have a standardized treatment and something that's going to give the best effect. And our profession is really, really poor at not, you know, standardizing what we do and kind of trying to maximize our treatment modalities. So using something like a tourniquet system, using a Doppler or Doppler-like system that we can measure each person's limb occlusion pressure so we know how much flow we're occluding is kind of standardized across groups, I think is important. But the most important thing is a tourniquet is a medical device. And if you're occluding flow on a patient and something were to go bad, all it takes is one lawyer to pull up all the tourniquet literature and say, what were you doing in the clinic? And you say, well, I was occluding his flow so we could do this BFR training. He said, well, if you're occluding flow, why weren't you using a medical tourniquet system? It's a, you know, your doctor, if your doctor took you in for a surgery on your knee and he said, I'm just going to wrap this band around your leg so I can occlude your flow, we would all have a big problem with that. And our profession, I think, needs to hold ourselves up to that same type of standard. And tourniquets are relatively safe, especially if you're using a tourniquet system and following, you know, what we know as the safe practice AORN guidelines. But tourniquets do have potential risks. And one risk can be, you know, pressure gradients that are created. They can cause a demyelination of a nerve. And so those are just the things I think clinicians need to be smart about.
And in that, I think it was in the Outside the Lines piece, right, where the physician that was speaking about it kind of made the comparison that when they put you down for surgery, they occlude all the blood flow and you're for mm-hmm. hours and you're perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. And this you're doing for minutes and it, you know, and you're exercising through it. So the potential yeah. risk is pretty low, seems like at least.
Yeah. But again, we're all using
right. With the monitoring to making sure it's done properly. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So
there's a big difference, you know. I mean, there was a pro guy last week we were working with, and when he was in college, he had an injury, and he said they had wrapped some stuff around his leg, and you know, and then he had a new injury that we were seeing him for in his pro career, and you know, we came in and used, you know, the system, got his limb occlusion pressure and all that, and he was like, oh my God, it didn't feel anything like this, you know, and so. We see that from people who are toying around with it and doing things on themselves when they actually try one of these, you know, real tourniquet systems and fully occlude flow, backup venous return.
The width is a big deal, right? On those tourniquet systems. I mean, if you take a band, especially one that has elasticity on it, and as you get tighter and the band becomes more elastic, the width becomes more narrow, which I'm guessing would increase the risk of, like you said, that demyelination of the nerve. And just, I mean, that's going to be incredibly uncomfortable versus I was looking at the ones you're using. Looks like it remains a consistent width throughout.
Yeah, it does. And it tries to maintain the pressure throughout. So as you're using it and going through contractions, you'll see it moving up and down where it's working with the contractions to maintain the pressure. The groups who have used some of the other stuff and some of the thinner ones, when we've gone in and worked with them, their patients like it a whole lot more. I mean, one college team basically abandoned doing BFR because none of their players wanted to use the thinner things that they were using. And now they're using, you know, the wider cuffs and they love it. So you have more surface area, which means you have a much, much lower pressure. I just talked with a researcher today who's a performance guy who was using a thinner band, and he was Dopplering, and, you know, he was getting pressures up in the 400s and still wasn't reaching full occlusion, which that's a lot of pressure through your limb. When you're using these wider tapered cuffs and we're measuring limb occlusion pressures, you know, we're getting like into the 200s. So it's much more tolerable.
Yeah, surface area and the force inversely proportionate or inversely related, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, people say like, well, what about the tourniquets, you know, the battlefield medics use or EMTs? And again, you know, those tourniquets, you know, the saying on them is they're to save a life, not a limb. And so they're more worried about just getting them on, being portable, trying to stop blood from pouring out rather than all the potential soft tissue damage that could be under it. You know, one of the worst days in medic training is when they have to go out there and put these, you know, these thinner tourniquets, battlefield tourniquets on and pump them up to full occlusion because it's just extremely painful.
Right. And to save the life.
You know, you talk about using a system and you're not only talking about the actual system from Delphi, but what we were wondering and what also Eric Hayford was wondering about particular dosing. You know, are there established protocols you're using basically that have been validated by research in terms of a system that you're using and how to, you know, recover someone from injury?
I hope you're enjoying this episode of Therapy Insiders with guest Johnny Owens. And before we get into Johnny answering about dosage for blood flow restriction training and continuing with a lot more Q&A from you, from social media and emails, let's take a minute to listen to our sponsors, WebPT and IntakeQ. At the start of this podcast, I told you that we're sponsored by WebPT, the end-to-end business solution for private practice rehab therapists, providing everything from documentation and scheduling to RCM services, billing software, and outcomes tracking. WebPT provides a free monthly webinar to help educate providers on being better in practice and business. So I grabbed Charlotte Bonet, who will be presenting with Dr. Heidi Jenanger on the webinar, and I asked her, hey, Char, the topic for your webinar this month is on PT billing. So what will people learn when they tune in?
Hey, Gene, great question. In an effort to improve their bottom lines, insurance companies sometimes use the vastly complex reimbursement rules and regulations to their advantage. But physical therapists don't have to be on the losing side of that game, especially if they know their payers' playbooks. In our upcoming webinar, Dr. Heidi Jenanger and I will unveil 5 top secret ways insurance companies beat providers on reimbursements and explain how they can turn the tables in their favor. We'll cover modifier mysteries, misbilling misfires, time code tangles, overpayment mismanagement, and contract quandaries. This 60-minute webinar is free and anyone can attend. Register now at webpt.com/ptbilling. That's webpt.com/ptbilling.
Thanks so much, Charlotte, and you should definitely check that out. Who doesn't want to learn how to better deal with insurance companies? Happens to be for free. Check it out, webpt.com/ptbilling. Therapy Insiders is also sponsored by IntakeQ. I grabbed Rachel, IntakeQ's customer success specialist. How cool is that title, right? And she shared what makes IntakeQ awesome, but she also shared a little bit more than that.
The whole idea behind IntakeQ is, you know, the patient experience. It's your very first interaction with your client, so of course you want it to go as smoothly as possible, and that's what we focus on primarily. We find it to be the most effective way and convenient as well in intake forms in general.
So you have a really cool accent. Where's it from?
Brazil.
Are you in Brazil right now?
No, right now I'm in Dublin.
Okay, is that where you usually do your work from?
No, actually, I'm actually a photographer. I help InterQ because it's the CEO, the owner, it's my ex-boyfriend. So I help him, but I'm a photographer, so I travel all over.
Whoa, so you're helping your ex-boyfriend?
Yeah, he's my best friend, so.
InterQ, improving the patient experience by modernizing the intake process while keeping relationships strong, even if it's an ex. Check out InterQ, that's with the letter Q, .com/UpDocMedia to get a discount and a free trial.
And now, back to Therapy Insiders with our guest, Johnny Owens. Let's get those Q&A answered about blood flow restriction training and everything else.
So there, you know, kind of the standard protocol that's in the, you know, most published in the literature is this four sets. You do a set of 30 with a 30-second rest period, and then three sets of 15 after that with a 30-second rest period, if we're looking for a strength and hypertrophy response. And so that's kind of the standard. We use that on the majority of our protocols when we're really moving into the strength and hypertrophy phase. You keep the cuff on throughout the entire treatment, so we really trap those metabolites and cause more cell swelling or a muscle pump during the rest period. That one works great. It seems to work great for us clinically. We're studying it in our clinical trials now. We tried things like failure sets, and I just think humans have a hard time sometimes taking themselves to failure. It seemed like our guys and girls were tapping out when it seemed like there was more in the tank. So when we use this protocol, which is a high volume, low load, it really seems like we get the muscle to failure. Because at the end of the day, that's our goal. If you get that muscle to failure, you can kind of do a mic drop. You did what you were supposed to do. Most rehab we do, we never get our patients to that point.
Yeah, but did you just reference a mic drop, a clinical mic drop?
Yeah, man, you guys don't do that. Actually, you drop your, you drop like a 1 pound weight. That's your mic.
Dude, we're in the business of podcasting. We literally don't drop mics. No. That's taboo here.
I know. You know how loud that would be?
That would be terrible. Terrible, awesome. Johnny.
Also, our mics, they weigh like 5 pounds.
Really?
Yeah, they're legit mics.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't even own a mic, so I don't know. As you guys can tell, by the way, we started this podcast.
There may have been technical difficulties, folks.
Yeah, there may have. It's always me.
Usually is. All right, back to the questions. All right, Alan Frendendahl asked, how well does strength translate working at such low intensity? It seems that even though a patient is getting the hypertrophy and endurance gains, that there wouldn't be the neuromuscular facilitation and motor unit recruitment that occurs during heavy strength training.
Well, you know, that's always kind of a loaded question.
No pun intended.
Yeah, right. And so for one, how do you really measure that? And if you're really trying to find a valid measure for power output, that's hard to do in a clinical setting. The studies that have measured strength show that strength is significantly elevated in many of them, along with the hypertrophy gains. And so it's not always just hypertrophy. People talk about this empty muscle type, you know, stuff. And at the end of the day, muscle is muscle. And if you can get your cross-sectional area there, then you're going to have, you know, the physics just play into it. So we see that strength changes occur. We see that EMG activity is increased locally, as well as some groups like Chris Bradner's work out in Qatar, that maybe even centrally. So from what we've seen, it's there. I don't really buy into the, well, you know, you're just put on hypertrophy and empty muscle. The big problem too is, you know, if I have a patient who's significantly atrophied, I want to get that muscle back. And again, our problem in PT is we have an inability lots of times to stop this anabolic resistance, and that muscle is just wasting away. So if we're able to turn on protein synthesis and restore muscle, at least to the size of the other limb, that's what we should be doing. And I don't think we need to really get mucked up in the you know, is this just hypertrophy and not strength? I think from what we're seeing with this, they go hand in hand, especially in the clinical setting.
So then Seth King asked, gains to musculature that is proximal to occlusion as well as distal question marks, are there gains proximal? For example, I've seen occlusion at brachial artery demonstrated for RC or delts. If so, how/why? Or do you have occlude proximal to distal target area only?
So we have seen some positive results clinically on some proximal musculature. There's also been some published papers that have shown increases in size as well as some of the 1RM strength measurements for the pec and the glute. So why does that happen? We don't have the exact mechanism. It could be a couple of things. So for one, you know, one of the pec studies showed that EMG activity increased at the pec more than it did with work match controls that weren't under occlusion. So because people throw out, well, is it just the systemic response? You're releasing all the anabolic factors and making it happen. Well, that wouldn't make EMG activity go up. So then we take a step back and say, well, why is that happening? So if say I'm doing, you know, a bench press type activity under occlusion, you might fatigue out your triceps so fast or relatively quicker than normal that your pec becomes more of a prime mover and it's having to take more work. That might also be what we see with something, you know, the one that showed the increase in glutes was a squat study. And so the quad might have just got smoked downstream, so the glutes had to take over as more of a prime mover. So that's one potential mechanism. The other one could be that there is a systemic response, and there's a couple papers where if folks put tourniquets on the lower legs and do low intensity work and then do some upper body work, that they see increases in strength and size compared to the control group. They've also measured the increase in systemic factors that might augment that to kind of support their case. And then the third one is potentially there a backflow of occlusion? So if you start, it's all plumbing. So if you start to occlude downstream, does it start to back up and you create a hypoxic effect in some of these more proximal muscles? So we'll see. We do have the Achilles tendinopathy study. We've seen very, very positive results in the lower leg. We've submitted for an Achilles repair study. And we also, with a civilian group, have submitted a rotator cuff repair study to not only see in the rotator cuff repair group, we help with strength and hypertrophy and functional changes as well as self-reported, but also T3MR to see if we are able to reduce fatty infiltrate. And that, awesome. That might possibly be through the growth hormone collagen synthesis cascade.
Sounds like you're hitting all the right injuries that we're commonly seeing in the clinic. And Keep Morgan.
Orthopedic ones, yeah. Well, and there's others, you know. There's some interesting, you know. We got some spinal cord stuff going on clinically that looks positive. Idiopathic myositis, muscle inflammatory, wasting diseases as well. So, yeah, the orthopedic sports med ones seem to be really low-hanging fruit and seem to be doing well. But there are some other interesting ones, even cardiovascular, cardiac rehab type stuff with this.
Sounds like if we have you on once a year, you'll just have a whole lot of new information for us. Well, Gabe Morgan, I'm sorry, Johnny, but I had this question as well. But Gabe Morgan had a question. Given the fact that this concept has been really gaining a lot of attention over the last few years, are there any contraindications or potential risk factors that may deem this type of training unsafe?
We do have... So if you come to a course, we do have a list of all the risk factors and the contraindication factors or the contraindications. It's fairly long because we don't understand all of them, or we don't have enough studies to know which ones really are or really aren't. I'd be happy to share that with you guys if you want to post it. But there's things, you know, like vascular grafting, we don't know. Peripheral vascular disease, we don't know. Cardiovascular conditions, we don't know. Although we're hoping to get a study going with a large university to look at that. Diabetes, we don't know. And so we just have to include those. And basically what we had to do, stepping back and looking in the medical device kind of safety guidelines with something like this, is if there's a reason why you couldn't be under a tourniquet for a surgery, then you probably don't need to be under a tourniquet within the clinical setting. Again, I think it's important for clinicians to understand that, because if they're putting a tourniquet on and the tourniquet literature says these things aren't safe for tourniquets to go into surgery, if you're throwing them on patients in the clinic and you haven't, you know, cleared it up the chain or whoever it would go through, then we're at risk. So yeah, there's some of those things that definitely we're trying to figure out.
Let's talk some numbers, Johnny. What have you seen? How are clinics that are taking BFR training and implementing, how are they charging it, billing it? What are the financials that go along with it?
So that one right now, it's basically being billed under TheraX. Some groups will do neuromuscular reeducation with it. In the military, because we can kind of bill anything, it seems like, we also bill vasopneumatic device, although some of the civilian clinics have said that that code doesn't really fly out there. What we're kind of, and this was something I was real naive to, and then the folks at the APTA have really helped me kind of understand this more. Getting a new code for something is extremely laborious and tricky. The last code that physical therapy was assigned was for aquatic therapy. And so what they said is, you know, you have to get the AMA on board. You have to, you know, come with positive, good multi-center type trials showing that this has an effect, which luckily enough, we've been able to get funded to do. And then you go forward and you ask, you know, is this worthy of a code? And so that's a long process, but, you know, the writing's on the wall. It looks like that this has got some legs. And so it might be up to groups like the APTA and others to look at obtaining a code when the time is right. The other issue is, you know, it looks like physical therapy might be going through a drastic shift in their coding from time-based to more, you know, complexity-based. And the people I talked to said this, in this current climate, it's probably not the best time to go kind of stir the pot because things are kind of shifting around. So that's what it is now. So if you're doing any exercise with it, you can bill for exercise. You know, we also look at, well, we're using a Doppler type device on this, so can we bill different for that? That's something they're looking at. So the potential might be there. What we do hear from clinics that are doing it, because they're kind of the early adopters, tip of the spear, is that marketing-wise, it's been a huge boom. I actually had a text from a gentleman that's doing it asking, you know, can he just get exclusivity in his area, because basically it's been a huge marketing boom for him with his orthopedic surgeons. I mean, and it helps when kind of the big dogs in orthopedics are really embracing this out there. It trickles down to the rest of that community.
Awesome. And what about the upfront cost? Like if somebody, let's start with your course. If somebody wants to get certified, how do they do that? Amy also asked, can students take the course? Are there any discounts for students? And then what are the costs of the devices, the tourniquet devices, the Dopplers, all the stuff, everything, Johnny, give them everything.
Give them everything, huh? Okay. So my website is owensrecoveryscience.com. And you can get a lot of that information there to take the course and get certified, because this is a medical device, you have to have a medical license. So PT, MD, OT, DC, ATC, I think I got them all. If you have a license, you can do it and get certified and be able to obtain this. PTAs and any others are more than welcome to come. And some clinicians who are doing this have sent their support staff as well to subsequent courses because they just feel like them understanding the science and application has helped. Students are also more than welcome to come, and we've had quite a bit of students come to some of the courses. You cannot purchase a device until you have graduated and obtain a medical license, but you'll be in the database with the company and with us to be able to get that. The course is $650. It's $450, I think, for students, so they do get a discount. And the device is $4,900, and that includes the system with a Doppler and three cuffs. And there is also a lease to own and a rent option just to help people, because we understand this is a lot of money lots of times for clinicians. It is a game changer, though. No one that has done it, and I can honestly say this, taking the course and also started implementing this, has not been anything but a huge fan and has called this a game changer and probably one of the biggest things to come through our profession since they've been around. And I agree. I mean, I'm really embracing it. Obviously, I'm biased, but it's because of just what I've seen with it. It's been really amazing.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of stuff, and I'm sure that in itself brings a lot of baggage, because as soon as people start putting on rhetoric and buzzwords, next big thing and the biggest thing and, yeah, you know, slice of bread, then it brings out a lot of skeptics and people starting to dig through it. And have you had negativity from it, from people that are just being negative before they even look at the research and look at what the outcomes are and just start breaking down all the potential negativity for it?
Yeah, for sure. But it's been minimal. And I don't really pay attention to any of that stuff anyway. So I just get so deep into a topic like this and that kind of just runs my life. So I know, you know, the science behind it, and I know what we've seen clinically. And also, you know, the big players and the people who are the ones that I'm really interested in seeing that they're agreeing with this are coming on board and are embracing this in a big way. So I'm not worried about the others. Usually it's someone who looks at it and says, ah, that's a bunch of crap. Oh my God, what are you doing? You're going to hurt someone or whatever. And then, you know, we get a 10 or 15 minutes into talking, and then all of a sudden, you know, they become the biggest fan. So I think it's just usually a lot of people, you know, don't take the minute to kind of listen to what really potential and what it is.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. Awesome, man. Well, it was great to catch up. It was great to get all the latest information. As soon as I posted you're going to be back on, it was just a flurry of interest. That definitely the mass media attention, I'm sure, helps, but it's cool to see it progress. Look forward to seeing you grow, and definitely got to get you out to Maryland, get a garage series set up for you.
Let me know, man. I want to get up there and get some of those crab cakes and show you guys how to really eat meat properly.
All right, look.
Strami or whatever the heck you guys do.
Listen, Johnny. Okay, look. Definitely it'll take you out to get a crab cake. And there's actually a really good pit beef place that was on a bunch of TV shows. But there is nothing wrong with a good corned beef sandwich.
I don't even have a response. You know, until we started talking, I didn't even know what a corned beef sandwich really was. I thought it was just like processed meat. So when I found out you guys were bastardizing brisket and doing that to it, I don't know if I'll ever be able to eat one again. I think I
want it is not. First of all, it's not bastardizing it. It's creating a different flair of flavor. I'm sorry that your taste buds are just smoked.
You're driving up brisket prices down here. So crab or whatever y'all eat up there.
Look, if you put a beef brisket, a corned beef brisket, in a crock pot for 8 hours in beer, I want to see you taste it and tell me that that does not taste delicious. Because if you tell me that to my face, you are a liar, my friend. You are a liar.
Now you're wasting beer, so double. Come on down here, and we'll show you how to do it right, brother. We eat our brisket.
Fair enough. I'll put the corned beef brisket to your. To your smoked brisket, and I want to see your face when you put it in your mouth and it just melts away in deliciousness, an explosion of flavor. But before that, you're going to try a crab cake when you come over to Maryland.
Definitely, I'll do that. So I'll be there in May, man, up there first week of May.
Awesome. We'll definitely have to find some time to meet up, maybe grab some dinner, and maybe do a little live Periscope or chat, do a quick Q&A, something like that.
Do it.
All right, Johnny. Thanks for joining us, man.
All right. Thanks, guys.